Good afternoon, gentlemen. We're now going to review for the summer, the first semester of summer 2020, contemporary halacha. We are going to begin with the shir on brain death presented by Rabbi Dr. David Shabtai. And the first part of the shir focused on explaining why you need a rabbi, not necessarily a doctor, to tell us whether brain death is death, because death is not something that we define medically, but the definition of life is something that is a value that is very much in the realm. We doctors could tell us what the body is doing or not doing, but as far as which of those bodily functions are considered life or not life, that's not necessarily a medical question. The introduction that we have to know is basically that the heart beats even if it is not connected to the brain. That being the case, it used to be that when a person would die, would stop to breathe, eventually stop their heart from beating. Because if there's no air coming into the lungs, so then their heart will stop after a few minutes. However, once we created respirators, ventilators in the 60s or 70s, all of a sudden, you have the possibility of air being pumped into the lungs, and providing the heart with oxygen. And once the heart has oxygen, the heart is able to continue to function. Now that would be true even if there is no brain activity. And therefore we have the question, if somebody is brain dead, there's no brain activity, their heart is still beating. So long as you continue pumping in air into that person's lungs, the heart will continue to beat even though the brain is doing nothing at all or just about nothing. So the question is that person alive or is that person dead? Again, we have to clarify, we're not talking about a coma, we're not talking about a vegetable, we're not talking about somebody who is unconscious, we are talking about somebody who is well beyond all of those things, where there is no brain activity, but still, since there's air being pumped in mechanically to the lungs, the person's heart continues to beat. So we're going to have two sources, and that's all we're going to do for this year. We're going to analyze two sources. The Gemara in Yuma, Daf Pei Gimel, says, Mechfakhen esagal v'shabbos. Of course, you could try to uncover somebody who is covered over by rubble. You could be Mechal Shabbos d'oraisa to try to save a life. When you finally get to him, you figure out, is he alive or dead? If he's alive, you're going to keep on being Mechal Shabbos to continue to save him. And the Gemara says, how do you check whether he's alive or dead? Machlokas, whether you check ad chotmo till his nose, or you check his ad libo till his heart. So the simple reading of this Gemara might read that the question is, do you check his nose, meaning his breathing, his respiration, and if there's respiration, then he's alive. And the other opinion says, ad libo, meaning you check his heart to see if his heart is beating, and if his heart is beating, then he's alive. If you would read like that, you would assume that the machlokas here is a machlokas. What is the definition of death? Is the definition of death respiration, breathing, or is it heartbeat? It's important to know that all the Rishonim passing that it's ad chotmo, so it sounds like the definition of death would be breathing. However, that is not how Rashi understands the Gemara. Rashi understands that the Gemara is not discussing what is considered death, heart death or respiration death. Rather, Rashi says that sometimes if you're checking a body, and let's say you find the feet first, and you get to the heart and you see that there's no heartbeat, Rashi says, check the nose also because maybe he's breathing. Meaning, and if he's breathing, Rashi says, then you know that his heart is beating. In other words, Rashi is learning that this is not a machlokas, what is considered death, but rather it's a machlokas, how to determine whether or not there's a heartbeat. Could you just check the heart? Is that sufficient? Or even if there's no... you can check the heart, but if you check the nose and there's respiration, then you know for certain the heart is still breathing because the heart always lasts longer than the breathing. Heart outdoes breathing. So if he's breathing, you know that his heart is beating, not the other way. If his heart is not beating, then he's dead. Perhaps that's what Rashi understands. But if he's breathing, then you know that his heart is still working, and therefore... This is understand. If I could just ask everybody to turn off your to mute yourself, so it'll be better for my audio. So according to the way Rashi reads this Gemara, the machlokas is everyone agrees that the heartbeat is what determines death. And the question is, how could you check whether the heart is beating? Is it enough just to check the heart, or do you need also to check the knows if there's breathing, and if there's breathing, then you know the heart is still beating. But it's really the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter. That's what counts as the heart. Now, if the heart is what counts, that means that as long as the heart is beating, the person is still alive. Now, based on what I told you 3 minutes ago, you could have a person whose brain is completely non-functional, whose brain dead, and his heart will still breathing, and his heart is still beating, and we are saying that that will be considered to be alive. So according to Rashi's understanding, it seems that brain death is not death because the heart is still beating and he would still be considered alive. That is the first source. The second source is a Mishnah in Ahalos. The Mishnah in Ahalos writes that a person who is decapitated, let's back up. When any animal is cut in half or a shechita happens, even after the shechita or you cut off the tail of a salamander, the animal remains have convulsions. They're mefarches, as Halacha describes it. It jumps up and down and it moves even after it's been killed. So the Mishnah in Ahalos writes that if a person is decapitated and they're still moving, guess what? They are metame. You might have thought that their movement demonstrates life and they're still alive until they stop wiggling around. Says the Mishnah that if you cut off the head, since you're cutting off the head, they are dead automatically, immediately, even if the body is still moving. So what do we see from that Mishnah? There are different ways to understand this Mishnah, and that different ways to understand this Mishnah will determine how you understand the halacha of brain death. So the Rabbanut in Eretz Yisrael says, oh, if you cut off his head, he's not breathing. So let me back up. The Rabbanut happens to say that brain death is death, against perhaps Rove of the modern day poskim. So the Rabbanut says that, hey, he's breathing. If you cut off his head, he's no longer breathing, so he's dead. Many other poskim, Rav Bleich presents it very clearly. Rav Bleich suggests that the Mishnah is telling us something very much more subtle and complicated. The Mishnah is telling you that normally, whenever you have movement in a body, any movement is considered a demonstration of life. The only exception is, says the Mishnah, that if you chop off a head, then any movement after chopping off a head, that's not considered movement of life. So in other words, any movement that you have in any which way is always considered that somebody's alive. If a person's heart is beating, they're alive. But once you chop off a head, then we won't consider any movement of their life to be considered, any movement within their body to be considered alive. And therefore, if you read the Mishnah like that, what comes out is that if the heart is beating, well, that's vital movement. There's something in the body that's moving, so the body's alive. How could you say that a body that has a moving part inside, a moving the heart is pumping, that they're dead? However, okay, once you chop off the head, then they'll be considered dead, even if the heart is beating. But so long as the head is attached, there has not been a decapitation, if their heart is beating, they are still considered alive. That is the other way to understand this Mishnah in Ahalos. Okay, that's all we're going to do for this shir. We're now going to go to the next shir. We're going to now do the shir about Tumas Konim, which will take us significantly more amount, a longer time to go through this shir. So the first thing that we have to realize is that there are different types of tuma. There's tumas maga, there's tumas masa, and there's tumas ohel. When it comes to a Gentile will create tumas maga, will create tumas masa. However, as far as being in the same ohel or being mahil over such a mace of an akum, there's machlokes tanoim, machlokes rishonim, and machlokes shulchan aruch and ramah. So in this case, the Shulchan Aruch is machmir to say that an akum is metami even ba'ohel. The Ramah is mekel, but the Ramah says lemais yishvi machmir, but mikra hadin. The Ramah is mekel. Now, based on that, let's introduce a new idea. There is a halacha called tuma b'chiburin. That means if in my right hand I'm touching a mace, my left hand I could. If I'm a kohen and I'm touching a mace in my right hand for whatever reason, my left hand I'm allowed to touch another mace. That's not a violation because I'm already bechibur and I'm already attached to a mace. I'm not adding on any more tumah. The question is, what happens if I'm not still holding on to the mace? But it's the same day that I got tummy this morning, and now if I become tameh the same day, I'm not going to be extending the 7 days of my tara process. So am I still allowed to touch a mace later in that same day? So the Rambam says no, but the Ravid says, since you're not being mosif tuma al tuma, so it will be permitted. So the Ravid says, oh, if that's the case, nowadays all of us are anyway tamei mace. If we're all anyway tamei mace, then we're always like tuma b'chibur. We're never being mosif tuma al tuma, since every day I consider myself tamei. Whenever I touch tuma again, I'm not adding anything. And therefore, according to this Ravid, we should, Kohen now, they should be able to touch a dead body. Now, of course, we don't hold from that Ravid. However, the Dalgul Meravava suggests that we could create a Svek Sveka. That maybe the halacha is like that by an Akum, there's no Tumas Ohel at all. And even if there is Tumas Ohel, maybe we hold like the Ravid who says that since anyway we're Tumeim, there's nothing wrong with becoming Tamei again. So that Dalgul Meravava would theoretically enable a Kohen to attend medical school, not to touch a dead body, but to be inside of a room where there is a dead body, because he has this Svek Sveka, Safek, again, I'll say Svek Sveka again, Safek, maybe this mace is not Metame Ba'ohel at all. And even if you say it is Metame, Safek, that since you're Tame anyway, and it's the same day that you're Tame, because we're all Bizman Hazet Tameim, you could go ahead and touch another a mace. However, even though that's a great Svek Sveka, this is not an option to allow people to be metamei lemeis and tumas ohel, or to go to medical school where they have cadavers in the same room. First of all, because the Ravid is a das yachid, and the Ravid himself may not even hold, might have been chozer bo from saying that tumah b'chiburin applies even if you're not touching it anymore. And even if the Ravid did say it and was not chozer bo, the Ravid might only have said that you don't get malkos if you touch a mace a second time, but not to mean that it's actually mutar l'chatchila. Next point. Rav Moshe says, was asked, maybe we could use the rule of safe sakonis nefashos. Would that be a good rationale to allow somebody to go to medical school? So Rav Moshe says, no, you can't use the svar sakonis nefashos, because even though you're required to save a life, you're not obligated to go to school to learn to save a life. That's svar number one. Svar number two, says Rav Moshe, we have Gentile doctors, so if you don't become a doctor, there are still Gentile doctors. Number three, we even have Jewish doctors who just happen not to be Kohanim. So therefore, one has no heter of Pikuach Nefesh to go to medical school. That's not the parameter of Pikuach Nefesh. Now, I did hear, possibly, I'm just telling you this for your own knowledge, a small school of thought. Maybe Rav David Cohen, I heard, might be making in some instances to allow somebody to go to medical school. But in general, the consensus opinion is that a Kohen cannot attend medical school and dental school, for that matter, because of the anatomy class. Let's talk now about Bikur Cholim. Well, before we get to Bikur Cholim, let's talk about Sof Tumah Latzeis. The halacha is that besides being concerned with Tumah being touching, we're not talking about touching, we're worried about Tumah in the building, Tumah under the same roof. So the halacha is that even if right now I'm in a room that's where the doors are closed, and therefore the Tumah is not coming into the room, if I will walk through a hallway, or walk through a doorway, or walk into an elevator, where a mace will later come into this room, or through this door, or through this hallway, then the halacha sees it as though the mace is there right now. That's the halacha sof tumah latzeis. And therefore, you not be able to walk through a door or an elevator where your mace would be carried even later. So if that's the case, there are basically no way that you could be in a hospital, that you or your Kohen could be in a hospital, walk through doorways or be in hallways, because maybe, you know, there's a mace somewhere on the other side of the hallway and he's going to be carried out through the same door that you're walking through now. So there is one sad lahakil, and that's based on the following. That it could be that if we're talking about a situation where rov mesim are akum, so the tuma, let's say like this. What's the reason why we have this halakha called sof tuma latzeis, that if the mace is going to go through a certain entranceway or hallway, we consider it to be there now. Perhaps one could argue that since there's a chiyuv of burying a mace, So you have to take him out through the doorway to get him to his kavura. But perhaps, as suggests the Yeshua's Yaakov, that since a mace akum does not have a chi of kavura, so theoretically you could leave a mace akum in the hospital room forever, halakhically at least. There's no mechayiv to take him out. And therefore, since no mechayiv to take him out, there might be no iser of softa malatzes. And if we add on to the fact that even the fact that an akum being in the ohel is itself subject to machlokas, maybe you have another, you know, like another chumra gabi chumra. Maybe tumas akum should not have the halachas of softa malatzes. And secondly, there is a leniency for akum in general for tumas ohel. So maybe we won't say the iser of softa malatzes. And you would be able, a kohen would be able to go into an elevator or a hallway where there might be a mace. It happens, but nowadays they usually use service elevators to carry out a mace. So that makes things a little bit better. Okay, let's go to the next point. What's the halacha with, by the way, could you please tell me, do you hear banging that is disruptive? You do hear banging?
Yeah.
Okay, let me try. Hold on a minute. Let me try to get my... Okay, so let's go to the next point. The next point is, what's the halacha regarding Bikur Cholim? So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that theoretically, when it comes to Bikur Cholim, we could suggest the following. Since the majority of Cholim in our Chutz La'aretz hospitals are Nachrim, and Me'ikr Hadin, we really assume that Tumas Akum, at least for Ashkenazim, Tumas Akum, Tumas Ohel is Mutter Ba'akum. Therefore, Litzorech Godol, you could allow a Kohen to visit his, to be Mevaker Cholim if there is a significant Sa'ar or there is a significant Sholem Bayis concern. So he's Mekel based on the fact that Rubo Akum. That is an important heter of Rav Moshe. Let's now talk about a pregnant Mrs. Cohen, an Ashes Cohen who's pregnant. So this Taka, you get calls from ladies, they're pregnant, but nobody knows they're pregnant because in their first few months before they're showing, and there's a family Levi. If they don't go, everyone's going to wonder, why didn't they go to the Levi? So can an Ashes Cohen go to a Levi? So once they're showing, they have a good excuse that they don't want to go to Levi because they can't. They're an Ashes Kohen, and the baby might be a Kohen because you're not allowed to take a baby Kohen into a Beis HaKvaras either. So the Shach cites the Rokeh who says that it should be mutter to take, for a pregnant Ashes Kohen, to take her fetus, to take her baby in her belly into the Beis HaKvaras. Why? Safek Nefel, Safek Ben Kayama. We don't know if it'll be a viable baby. And secondly, Safek Zachar, Safek Nekeva. And only a Zachar has the halacha of Isser of Tumas Akum. That's the Svek Sveka of the Rokeach. Now, the Magen Avraham asks a very simple question. Why do you have to come on to the Svek Sveka? Why don't we say that whenever you have Tuma Blua or Tara Blua, it doesn't become Tame? If anything is swallowed up inside, it doesn't become Tame. So if the baby is swallowed up inside his mother's belly, he shouldn't become Tame. So that's halach in Hilchas Tuma Vatara. So Reb Chaim Oz and Achiezer answers with a big yisod. He says that the isur of Tumas Akum, of Tumas Kohanim, is not that a Kohen cannot become Tame. This is a big yisod, which we're going to see another two times during the shir. It's not that the Kohen cannot become Tame, it's that the Kohen can't be Karov Lemes. So even if you tell me that because of Tahara Blua, the baby will not actually become Tame, but still, he's going to be in an Ohel HaMeis or in a cemetery, he's going to be Karev LaMeis, it'll still be Aser. That's an interesting answer to Reb Chaim Ozer, to the Kasha of the Magen Avraham. Now, nowadays, if we say that the whole heter to allow an Ashes Kohen into a cemetery is a Svek Sveka, nowadays when we have ultrasound, you don't really have the Safek Zachar Safek Nekeva, because with an ultrasound we know if it's a Zachar Nekeva. So we don't really have that Svek Sveka nowadays of the Rokeach. Okay, let's go to another point. Can you drive? I've had this shaili. I have a Kohen who wants to visit his cemetery where his parents are buried. So could he go in a car? So is a car chotzeitz? Now the halacha is that if you're in a capsule, and a box, and that box is chotzeitz mipnei tumah, you could go in a place that's tameh, like a shita teva migdal, like the Gemara talks about, because the tumah is contained out, it insulates you. So the question is an ohel like an automobile, like a car, is that going to be chotzeitz mipnei hatumah? So the halacha is that a car is not chotzeitz mipnei hatumah, and it will still be problematic, because an ohel, zaruk lo shmei ohel. That's one reason. And the car is moving, so it's an ohel zaruk, so therefore it does not have a din of an ohel. There cannot be chotzeitz mipnei hatumah. The tumah will transfer into the car and mess up the kohen. Number two, even if you assume that it is an ohel, the problem is that it's metal. And anything that's mekabel tumah, like a metal car, cannot be chotzeitz bifnei hatumah. There are some suggestions. Okay, let's leave it at that. Again, I'm just giving you a very abridged version. Let's talk now about airplanes over cemeteries. When you have tumas ohel, so one is sort of tumas, one aspect of tumas ohel is being in the same ohel as being in the same ohel as a mace. Another aspect is that you're not allowed to be ma'ahil over a mace. You can't fly or jump over a kever. So can an airplane fly over a cemetery, which is a shiloh with a Lod cemetery? Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam she'akol nehiyeh bedvaro. Can we suggest that the plane will be chotzeitz b'fnei hatumah? Well, a plane might be also ol zarek, which is lo shmei ohel. Secondly, what's the status of the plane? Is the plane metal? And if it's metal, cannot be chotzeitz b'fnei hatumah. Well, the Torah only lists six metals: gold, silver, copper, iron, lead, tin. Now, when the Torah says these six metals, is that exhaustive? Only these are metals? Or are they just giving us examples of what constitutes metal, but anything else that's similar to that will also be metal and therefore will also be mekabel tumah? So now that planes are aluminum, which is not one of the metals listed in the Torah, does that mean that it's not mekabel tumah? So the Gra in the Mishnayah says that only those six metals mentioned in the Torah are metal, and an aluminum plane is not metal, and therefore it could be chotzeitz b'fnei hatumah. But other Mefarshim Mishnah Tiferes Yisrael says anything that's similar to metal, like aluminum, will also be mekabel tumah. So therefore, the plane going over a cemetery is going to be problematic. Except if we mention, as I said before, that Achiezer, Rosh Hashanah suggested, based on the Achiezer we said 3 minutes ago, the Achiezer said that the Isser of a Kohen to contract tumah is not to become tumah in Hilchos Tumah V'Tara, but rather the Isser of Tumas Kohanim is to be karov to a mace. And if a plane is flying at 5,000 feet or 3,000 feet above a cemetery, although technically they became tameh, but as far as Tumas Kohanim is concerned, they did not have a kirva lemace, and perhaps that would become, that would not be oser. So that was Rosh Hashanah's kula. Now let's talk about a different shiloh relating to airplanes, and that's can a Kohen fly in an airplane where there is a mace in the cargo? So the idea again is to put the mace into a box that will be chotzeitz b'fnei hatumah, that will insulate the tumah inside of it, like a box made out of plastic or something that it's not mekabel tumah. And then you contain the tumah in there, and the kohen could be under the same roof of the airplane. That should be fine. That's the goal. However, we're going to mention a number of problems. Number one, maybe the box itself is an ohel zarek. Why? Because the box, even though the box isn't flying through the air, the box is in a plane which is flying through the air, so ultimately the box is flying through the air. And if it's an ohel zaruk, then it will not be chotzeitz, as we mentioned earlier. So that's just a question of how you look at something that's in a flying plane. Is it considered flying or is it not considered flying? Because relative to everybody else, it's not flying, but it is l'maisa flying through the air. Others say that maybe the very fact that the box is sitting on a plane which is mekabel tumah because it's aluminum, or something of that matter, so then this box that's holding the coffin has a maimed b'davar ha-mekabel tumah. And we know that a maimed b'davar ha-mekabel tumah also is not able to be chotzeitz b'fnei hatumah. So that would be another problem for the box. So therefore, it's best for a kohen not to fly in a plane that has a mace on it. Okay, that's the end of that shir. Let's now go to Dina de Malchusa Dina. Okay, so this is Rosh Hashanah's shir on Dina de Malchusa Dina. So the first point that we have to know is that the halacha is only dina de malchusa dina, but not gazlanusa de malchusa. So if something is unfair, something is cheating, and the government is involved in a taking advantage and stripping the Jews of their wealth, we're not going to say dina de malchusa dina. Now, what's the source of dina de malchusa dina? So the source is a gemara that talks about a melech. And there's a question, what the rights of a melech have? Does a melech have, when the Torah tells us all the things that a melech could do, when Shmuel HaNavi warns Bnei Yisrael, you sure you want a melech? You know there's all the things that they could do? So does that mean that the king's a melech is allowed to do those things? Or Shmuel HaNavi was just trying to scare Bnei Yisrael? So it seems that the Shulchan Aruch assumes that whatever Shmuel HaNavi was scaring Klai Yisrael, not just that he was trying to scare Yisrael, but indeed a melech or a government has the right to do those things, and one of them is to tax its subjects. And that's why Shmuel Melech said, you really want a melech, he's going to tax you. And the Shulchan Aruch says that that's the source, that a melech has the right, a melech or a government has the right to tax. And by the way, where did Shmuel HaNavi live? Three options. He lived in France, he lived in America, or he lived in Eretz Yisrael. Yes, you got it, he lived in Eretz Yisrael. What do you see from this? You see from this that even in Eretz Yisrael, the melech has the right, the government has the right to charge taxes. And that's what the poskim say. Even though everyone likes to banty about a Ran in Nedarim, who says that there's no, the concept of taxation is based on the owner of the land, the king who owns the land, to tax his people, and therefore in Eretz Yisrael, where we all own Eretz Yisrael, no one should be able to tax us because we all own the land. However, that Ran in Adam does not make its way into the Shulchan Aruch, not even as a Yesh Omrim, and therefore it seems that we don't paskin like that opinion of the Ran in Adam, who says that there's no taxes in Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam, when he talks about taxes, describes taxes as since the melech has a right to collect taxes, if you don't pay taxes, you're gozel menas hamelech. There is a Mishnah l'melech who suggests that maybe one wouldn't have to pay taxes based on the following logic, that we know that hafkas milva of a guy, of a Gentile, is mutter. Meaning, if an akum lends you money and you avoid paying that money, so that is not the same as Gneva or Gzela, and that is not Aser. So the Mishnah Melech suggests that maybe the money that you owe the king is not, if he doesn't collect it from you, then you don't have to pay it on your own. The problem is that we don't really pass like that Mishnah Melech. So if that's the case, so as Rabbi Shechter suggests, the reason why a person has to pay taxes is not based on the regular din of dina de machusa dina, Rav Shechter says, because although that might apply, but that's not how it works in our government. Because now it's not the government just trying to take money from us. Rather, Rav Shechter suggested that our taxes in our democratic states are based on the halachas of shutfin, that if you ever have a group of people live in an area and they share certain needs, they're automatically joined together as shutfin, even though they never made a formal shutfus. And the halacha is that you follow the majority of what those shutfin want to do. So therefore, since I am in New York City, or whatever town I'm in, that I have to pay taxes, I am a shutfus in New York City. And I'm in New York State, I'm a shutfus in New York State. I'm in the United States of America, so I'm a shutfus in the federal government as well. And therefore, since I'm in a shutfus in these three municipalities, if you say, or regions, or jurisdictions, so I am bound by the majority rule. If the majority rule want that there should be public school taxes for public schools, even though I send my kids and I pay private tuitions to yeshivas, I don't have a choice to withdraw because I'm a partner. And as a partner, I am bound to follow the decision of the majority of that shutfus. So therefore, if I would not pay taxes, even though they don't claim the taxes from me, or they don't run after me for a specific tax, but if I owe that tax, so I'm stealing from the shutfus. And by the way, who's in that shutfus? Part of the people in that shutfus are other Yisraelim. And therefore, Rav Shechter would be saying that it would be a situation of gezel from your shutfin, your Gentile shutfin as well as your Yisraeli shutfin, and that would be the problem of tax evasion. Okay, that's as far as taxes. Now, let's talk about Dina de Machlus Dina specifically. Where does Dina de Malchus Adina manifest itself? Hold on a second, please. So, number one, Dina de Malchus Adina allows a government to charge taxes, as we mentioned. Secondly, it allows a government to define what is kesef, which is important because you have to know what you could use for in Hilchos Ribis. We have to know what's kesef, what's peira, what's tiva. Not going into that now. For Pidyon Maisa Sheni, you can only be Poda your Maisa Sheni on kesef that was established by a Medina. So if you don't hold from the Medina, you're not going to be able to use a shekel for Pidyon Maisa Sheni. So it's important to know what the definition of kesef is. Thirdly, Dina de Malchus Adina has the ability to enforce, to punish. And fourthly, Dina de Malchus Adina could introduce laws, legislation. Those are the four things that Dina de Malchus could do. Let's say, but when do we apply Dina de Malchus Adina? So whenever you have a fight with another Jew, we're not going to use Dina de Malchus Adina, we're going to use the halacha. Dina de Malchus Adina applies only when it's you versus a Gentile. That's when we apply the rules of Dina de Malchus Adina. Well, Gentile against Gentile, of course they're going to follow Dina de Malchus Adina because that's the law system that they have. Jew against Jew will not be bound by Dina de Malchus Adina. So if you have an argument with somebody else, they can't scream and shry, oh, Dina de Malchus Adina, because that's only when it's a Jew versus a guy. If it's two Jews against one another, then we will always apply Torah law. Where did we see that? The famous case was from the Maritz Sahalon, who was very strong in telling people all around the world that when it comes to Hilchos Yerusha, you will never follow the Gentile laws of Yerusha, because Yerusha by definition is two Jews arguing with each other, two brothers or brother and sister, whatever it is. They are both Jews, and therefore they have to follow Hilchos Yerusha and not Dina de Malchus Adina. Once we're talking about Yerusha, let's just add one other point. The Rambam says another reason why you do not follow the laws of the land, because Yerusha, the Rambam has this drasha that says, the Torah says it's a chukas mishpat, which is like a chok, and therefore it's like iser v'heter, where of course we don't apply Dina de Malchus Adina, we only use Dina de Malchus Adina for mamonis, not for iser v'heter. Now, even though we mentioned that we never apply Dina de Malchus Adina between Jews, Rav Henkin did identify a number of cases where we can use Dina de Malchus Adina to apply even between Jews. He says that whenever the legislation of the government was Latikun HaMedina, so since it's Latikun HaMedina and it's to benefit the Jews as well, then Jews also, it's to benefit Jews and non-Jews alike, then Jews also will be bound by that. So for example, rent control, minimum wage, bankruptcy, these are all things that are legislated to Latovas, Latikun HaMedina. And therefore, if a Jew has a fight with another Jew, with his landlord or with his tenant, or an employer with his employee, and they have a fight about minimum wage, or there's a bankruptcy between that, and there's a creditor and a debtor, both are Jewish, then we can use the rules of Dina de Malchus Adina even between two Jews. That's one area where Rav Henkin says you apply Dina de Malchus Adina even between two Jews. Another one is the Shach adds two more scenarios where we will apply Dina de Malchus Adina between two Jews. If both parties are Jewish and Halacha does not state an opinion. So if Halacha doesn't say anything, so what are we going to do? We'll default to Dina de Malchus Adina. Chazanish says no such case. Halacha always has an opinion, just like Jews always have an opinion. And finally, the second case of the Shach, which is the third area that we're citing, where there is Dina de Malchus Adina even between two Jews, is let's say you have a store or a business, and your clients are both Jewish and non-Jewish alike. It's impossible for you to have two sets of rules. You have the warranty for Gentiles and the halachic warranty. You have the policy for Gentiles, and you have the halachic policy for the Jews. That's impossible, even though it's you and a Jewish client. But since you have non-Jewish clients, it's clearly understood that anyone who walks into such a store understands that you're going to be following the Dina de Malchus Adina, and it's ki'ilu hisnu, even though there's no tanai that was articulated, but anyone who walks into such a store understands that they're going to be dealt with as though, through the Dina de Malchus Adina, because there's no other way to operate such a business without following Dina de Malchus Adina. Okay. Now, that was the first half of the shiur. Now let's go to the second half. The second half of the shiur is going to be talking about Mesira. So I will tell you something very important, that Rav Schechter gave a shiur about Mesira and presented his presentation, which I will do right now. You should know that Rav Moshe Feinstein does not hold from this presentation that I'm about to present to you. And therefore, when you go into the real world and you have a certain preconceived notions of what Mesira is and when you're allowed to call the police and when you're allowed to involve the authorities, and other people will say, you know, are you crazy? Are you off your rocker? It's even first against Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe says that you're a Moser and then you go straight to Gehenna if you call the police in this case. Now you will be intelligent to know that you might be aware of Rav Schechter's opinion, but Rav Moshe is much more stringent about calling the police, involving the authorities in various cases, and I'll try to identify when we get to that point. So, number one, says Rav Schechter that let's start with the story. The story of Metzia Daf Pei Gimel was that the son of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai was hired by the Roman government to find Jewish criminals and Jewish robbers, thieves, and the Roman government would kill those thieves, those Jewish thieves. So what do you see? Oh, and I'm sorry, and Eliyahu HaNavi comes and meets up with Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son and says, hey, what are you doing? Why are you turning these Jews over to the Roman authorities to be killed? And Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son says, I'm just being getting rid of the garbage in the Jews. I'm getting rid of the kotzim and hakerem. And Eliyahu HaNavi responds, let Hashem take care of it. It's not your job. So a number of the Rishonim say, you see from Eliyahu HaNavi's response that it's not usur, it's just not the right thing for a good Jewish boy to do. So based on this, these Rishonim seem to hold that even if you would be causing a fellow Jew to get a punishment that's far greater than the Torah's definition of the punishment, it is still permitted to turn a Jew over to the authorities. When do we say that something is Mesira? Something is Mesira is... Let's hold on for a second. It has to be, in order to be able to turn somebody over to the authorities, that they did something that's usur. They did something that's usur. And if they did something that's usur, then, and it's illegal, it also has to be usur according to halacha. If it's not usur according to halacha, then there's no... You can't turn them over. But if they did something that's usur according to halacha, and it's illegal, then you could turn them over to the authorities, even if the authorities have a stronger punishment than the Torah law provides. That only means that you're allowed to put them in a situation where they're going to get the government's punishment, whatever the government's punishment is. However, let's say if you would turn the person in, he'd get even more than the government punishes. For example, there might be some prisons where a Jew could get beaten up or a Jew could get killed. So even though the government says if you do this, you did something wrong, you're going to go, you did insurance fraud, you have to go to prison. Okay, so maybe you'd be able to turn the person in for that. But what happens is the guy goes to prison and he gets beaten up. That's not what the government said. That's more than what Dina D'Malchus Dina requires. In that case, you would not be able to do Mesira. You'd not be able to turn the person over to the government because there he's getting more than even what the Goyisha law determines. And in such a case, it would be prohibited to call the authorities. Now, Rav Moshe rejects this proof. This is not in the Shir, I'm just telling you. Rav Moshe rejects the proof from the story of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son who met Eliyahu, who was turning over people to the government. So Rav Moshe knew all these sources. Rav Moshe says that's because Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son was hired by the Roman authorities to turn them over. And therefore, if you're working for the government, then you're allowed to maybe turn people over. But if you're an ADA, you're a prosecutor, something like that. But if you are just not working for the government and you're going to call the police that somebody stole, then you will. That will be indeed a violation of Mesira with all the terrible curses that are befitting somebody who does Mesira. Let's say there will be a Chil Hashem. Let's say that a guy gets subpoenaed to testify in a court case. A Jew gets this, a guy in your shul gets subpoenaed to testify in a court case. And the Jew says, hey, it's a court case against a fellow Jew, and if I testify, I could cause him to go to jail or something. So if I don't testify, that's going to be, if I testify, that could be Mesira. So Rav Schechter quoted the Gra, who explains that if there's going to be a Chil Hashem, then one is permitted to testify, and there will not be an issur of mesira in the opportunity to fulfill, to avoid a chilul Hashem. When else? So when are we not allowed to do the mesira? We're not allowed to do mesira when the classical case of mesira is when a person comes to the Jewish community and says, "Okay, who has money? I want to steal money from the Jews. I want to tax the Jews unfairly." And you say, "So and so, so and so, so and so." That's mesira, and that's where the Torah has terrible, the Gemara has terrible curses for what we do to a moser. So if there's no good reason to turn a person over, then it's a terrible, terrible thing. Okay, there are another two cases that the Shulchan Aruch does permit to do Mesirah. Again, what does Mesirah mean? Mesirah means that they're going to suffer more than they should. You're never allowed to make somebody suffer more than they should, either according to Halacha or according to the secular law, as Rav Shechta suggests, not Rav Moshe. Again, Rav Moshe says you can't cause them to get punished anything more than Jewish law would require, that if you would call the police and they would get in trouble more than Jewish law would get them in trouble, that's already considered Mesira in Rav Moshe Feinstein's estimation. There are two cases where you're permitted to do Mesira, meaning to cause the person even more suffering than they deserve. One is if a person is a Meitzer Es HaRabim, he causes pain to the Rabim, like a pedophile, a consistent, someone who's abusing, a con artist. Then you're allowed to send him even to like one of those prisons where he might suffer even more than he deserves, more than what it says on the books, maybe even somebody who does a Ponzi scheme, then it would be permitted. That's one thing the Shulchan Aruch says. And a second thing is maka es chavero. So for example, if you notice that somebody in your neighborhood or a student in a school is bruised from abuse or from father, parent or anybody else, so maka es chavero, that might also be a case where mesira is permitted, and even if the person would be punished more than the halacha and more than the din of the mechuzadina dictates, it would be permitted to be most of them. Okay, that's the end of that shiur. For which one? For a source for what? Oh, Meitzar Es HaRabim. That is the... I just closed my file. Hold on. You'll text me afterwards. That's in the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchas Mesira. I'll have to look exactly where it is. You'll check with me afterwards. Okay. Let us now do something a little bit lighter. That was a heavy shiur. Let's talk about something a little bit lighter. Okay. Now let's talk about child care on Shabbos. That was just a few days ago. So we'll talk about all the different aspects of child care on Shabbos. So let's talk about a woman who wants to nurse. So, of course, nursing is mutter on Shabbos. However, if one would squeeze out the milk of a cow or of a woman squeezing out her own milk, that is actually an iser mide oraisa. What happens, however, if you have a woman who's in a lot of pain and she has to express the milk because she's bursting, as if it were, which is what women experience, how are we going to alleviate her pain? So it could be if we knock down the milk expressing to an Isser D'Rabbanan, then B'Makom Tsar, we would permit it. How do we do that? That might be achieved if we are Cholev Le'ibud. So for example, this is true not just by women, this is true by cows also. Let's say you have a cow that needs to be, even though you're not allowed to milk a cow on Shabbos, but the cow needs to be milked, otherwise the mother cow is going to feel like she's bursting. So we, since it's B'Makom Tsar, and we're going to knock the Disha, that's the Melacha involved, down to Nisud Rabbanan, we could do so by being Cholev Le'ibud. And if we Cholev Le'ibud to make the milk go into the garbage, that will make it into a malacha shein etzrich legufa, because we're not using the milk, and therefore it will be mutter. Now, according to that you have to turn the milking into a malacha shein etzrich legufa to knock it down to the Rabbanan, that will make it mutter as long as you throw out the milk. You don't necessarily have to squeeze the milk into a garbage can, a drain, or into soap right away. As long as it goes to the garbage, ultimately it's malacha shein etzrich legufa. However, the others say that it's only considered. The Chazon Ish says you have to. It's only considered l'ibud if it goes immediately l'ibud mitchila. It's not like you put it into the bottle and then pour the bottle down the sink. It has to go straight into soap, straight into the drain, and that's the only way that you could make it mutter. So therefore, halach l'maisa, if a woman for whatever reason has to alleviate her pain and has to express her milk because her baby is not feeding, then there's no way you could use that milk. That's also d'oraisa. You can never nurse into a bottle or pump into a bottle for the milk to be stored. The milk has to be destroyed. The question is, does it have to be destroyed, you know, afterwards, or does it have to be destroyed as it's coming out into putting, like, for example, putting a little bit of soap on the bottom of the pump for the woman? Let's say a woman has an electric pump. So obviously, if you could set it up on a Shabbos clock or have a guy turn on the electric pump, that would be ideal. If there's no Shabbos clock that was set up, and she only has an electric pump, and there's no guy, can you use the electricity? So, Mikr Hadin, hold on 1 second, please. Check my email. Look for garage combination. Sorry. Mikr Hadin, one can you do the electricity kila achar yad, and since electricity is probably drabanan, and you're doing kila achar yad, and it's malkam tzorech, one can, as a last resort, turn on a pump on Shabbos, kila achar yad, when a woman is in great tzar. Okay. That's as far as the electricity is concerned. I'm not talking about the disha component. I'm talking just about the electricity component. As far as the disha component, you'd have to put some soap onto the bottom of the pump so that when the milk comes out, the milk will be ruined immediately when it comes out of her body into the bottle. No, if you're feeding a baby, if a woman is nursing a baby, then she's nursing a baby. But if she's putting it in a bottle and then feeding it to a baby, that's asur d'oraisa. That's asur d'oraisa. A woman cannot put it into a bottle and then give the bottle to the baby. That's asur d'oraisa. That's Dishon Shabbos. Okay. Now, let's talk about, you have this bottle of milk, and now you take a bottle of milk out of the freezer. Mother's milk stores very well in a freezer. And now you want to warm it up for the little baby. So because mother's milk was never previously pasteurized like the milk in your refrigerator, it was never mevushel, so it will indeed be a problem to warm it up to ever get to Yad Soledes Bo. So you have to be very careful that if you're going to take the bottle of milk and put it into, let's say, like a Netilas Yadayim cup filled with hot water, you want to make sure that it doesn't get to Yad Soledes Bo. Some are makel if you put it into a klishlishi. You put the hot water urn into one cup and then put it into a bowl and then immerse the frozen milk or the cold milk into that. But that's already machlokas if kli shlishi is mevashel, it's not mevashel. So just trying to make sure that the milk is never going to reach Yad Soledes Bo. Okay, let's now talk about baby cereal or oatmeal. The main problem that with this, the melach we're asked before we spoke about disha, now we'll speak about lisha. So lisha is, you take a liquid and you take a powder and you make it into a mush. That's what lisha means. There's machlokas when the moment of iser of lisha is. Is it when you pour the water into the powder, or is it when you do the act of kneading with a K, K-N-E-A-D? So perhaps if we make a shinui in the moment of becoming iser, then there will be more room to be makel. Then we can knock it down to an iser d'rabbanan. So how do you make a shinui? Well, since we don't know when the Shas Isra is it the Shas Nesinas Hamayim or the Shas Gibel when you need it? So you're going to have to make a shinui in both of them. You're going to have to pour the water in the wrong direction, meaning if normally you put in the powder, then the water, you have to do first the water, then the powder. And also you're going to have to do a change, a shinui in the kneading, in the mixing. Instead of mixing normally, you have to mix, I don't know, with like a crisscross, with an X, with taking your fingers out, with your fingers, all kinds of changes in the Gibel. But still, that only knocks it down to a derabanan. It's still also derabanan to mix this. So what we'll also do is that we'll have to add another derabanan. And that would be by turning the lisha into a blila raka. Because lisha d'araisa is only if it's a dough. But if it's a batter, a watery batter, that's what we call blila raka, then it's only going to be lisha d'rabanan. So if you do both of these things, you add a lot of water, so that's a blila raka, and now it's only d'rabanan. And you do a shinui with both possible situations of when the kibul, when the isur lisha applies, then it'll be a double d'rabanan, and certainly if the baby doesn't eat other foods, you have a way to be mako. But again, this is not for you to make yourself oatmeal on Shabbos. You could eat other foods, but if a baby who doesn't eat other foods, then will be willing to be mako this double kula, this d'rabanan on a d'rabanan, if it's necessary, and you would be able to do that. Okay, now we're going to talk about another malacha, the malacha of tochen. Let's say the baby is no longer eating baby cereal, the baby is actually eating real foods, but you have to cut them into small chunks. So what are you going to do? You have to cut up the chicken, you have to cut up the vegetables into small pieces. Well, I just made a joke. When you cut up chicken, chicken is not kidule karka. Chicken, you're allowed to dice meat and chicken and eggs because since they don't grow in the ground, there's no iser of tochen on them. And similarly, there's no iser of tochen on pretzels or baked goods, like pretzels, cookies. You're allowed to crumble them on Shabbos. There's no tochen because ain't tochen achar tochen. So there's no tochen on things that are not kidule karka, like chicken, meat, or eggs. There's no tochen on things that were already made out of flour, like pretzels, cookies, and breads, and all that. So we just have to talk about tochen for vegetables and for fruit. So if I will grind it up, of course, that's Issur D'oraisa, but it's also going to be aser to cut it up into small pieces. How small is small? So says the Urayim, cited by the Mishabru, we don't know how small is small. So it's going to be very difficult to say, oh, I won't cut it so small, and that's okay, because we don't really know how small you have to cut it. However, there is a Rashba who has a kula. The Rashba says that if we look at the halachas of Borer, and Borer is done la'altar, or right before the Seuda, that's not called a malacha of Borer, that's just derech achila. And therefore you're allowed to do Borer in whatever situations right before the Seuda. Says the Rashba, just like we have that kula by Borer, we could extend that kula from Borer also to Tochein. And therefore if you will be Tochein right before the Seuda, it will be permitted for you to be Tochein. So what does that mean? That means that if you're going to, during the meal or right before the meal, you're going to chop up your salad for your baby or for you for making a salad. Here there's no difference between babies and adults. If you're going to do it right before the meal, the Rashba would permit. However, the Mishnah Berurah questions if you should just rely on the Rashba himself. And therefore the Mishnah Berurah suggests that you should have a dual pronged approach. You should A, do it right before the meal, and B, try to cut the pieces larger than, not just larger than more, they shouldn't be small pieces, they should be larger pieces, and it should be right before the meals. If you do both of those together, then you could cut yourself a salad or cut up the vegetables or fruits for the baby, excuse me. I had a shaila this past Shabbos afternoon at Shala Shudas. One of the kids was mushing banana to eat with their, I don't know, the cottage cheese or something like that, or farmer cheese. And without thinking, that's just what happened at the table. And all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, we just did what Rabbi Sobolowski talked about, mushing bananas on Shabbos. Mushing bananas on Shabbos, the Chazon Ish says, is an Isser D'oraisa. He says it's not only like, it's worse than just cutting fruit, because this is more similar to chopping up, making into a fine powder like tochin d'oraisa. When you're toching the kernels of wheat into flour, so too when you're mashing the banana into a mush, it's more like the real toching d'oraisa, and it's even worse than cutting up vegetables where the Rashba was makel if you do it right before Shabbos, right before the Seuda. Mushing a banana, which is like the real toching d'oraisa, making flour out of wheat kernels, would be such real toching that it's also even samach l'Seuda. And therefore, the Chazon Ish holds it would be asur d'oraisa to mush a banana and to mush an avocado when you're making it into a big mush. The Rav Moshe Feinstein says, I don't understand, because the whole point of tochen is that you're taking a kernel and breaking it into many pieces. When you take a banana, you're mushing it into one mush. When you take an avocado, you're mushing it into one mush. You're not breaking it into small pieces. So Rav Moshe says, I don't think this should be tochen at all. However, the Chazon Ish says it's an Issur D'oraisa, we're not going to allow it. However, the Chazon Ish, although he gave a tremendous chumrah saying it's an Issur D'oraisa, did say, however, if you do it kila'acha yad, like with the back of a spoon or the back of a knife,
that will make it mutter gomer.
Well, Rav Moshe says, why in the world? If something's asur d'oraisa, why would doing a kila'achaya make it mutter l'chatchila? Usually kila'achaya just knocks it down to be a d'rabbanan. It doesn't make a mutter. Well, anyway, says Rav Moshe, I don't understand why it should be asur in the first place. And the Chazanir says that it's asur, okay, but if he himself tells me that if you do a kila'achaya, it's okay, so that's what we should do. So halach l'maisa, Rav Moshe honors the Chazanish by saying that don't mush your bananas, don't mush your avocados, unless you do a kila'achayad. But if you do a kila'achayad, then Rav Moshe says everything should always be mutter, but even the Chazanish will permit it. Let's now talk about diaper changing. One issue is, of course, baby wipes, where there's water. The whole question among the poskim is the water on top of the wipe, is the water inside the wipe, and is it squeezing? Do you want the water to come out? So that's one machlokas. Another issue when it comes to diapers is the tabs to attach the diapers. When you undo the diapers, now keep in mind there are two kinds of diapers. There are diapers that have adhesive tabs, and there are diapers that have Velcro tabs. Velcro is, if you look at it under a magnifying glass, you'll see that Velcro is just really eyes and hooks. You have an eye and a hook. They're just like very tiny, so that's how the Velcro works. When you have an eye piece and a hook piece, and you lock it together, Velcro works. Look at it under a microscope or a magnifying glass, you'll see what I mean. However, if you have an adhesive tab where there's glue involved, that's what we're talking about. So you have to see which kind of diapers you have. If you have the ones with adhesive tabs that have some glue, then we have to talk about two problems. First of all, when you open up the diaper, you're opening that adhesive tab. Opening is korea. And then when you go to attach the diaper onto the baby, that's tofer. Because when you take pieces of things that are glued together and unglue them, like a sticker off the sticker or a sheet of stickers, that's koraya. When you take something and stick it on, and your madbik niros together, that's tofer. So perhaps we could have a kula. Perhaps the kula could be that we know that in the sugi of kosher, of kesher, it's only asr if it's shel kayama. Perhaps we could argue that maybe when you're tofer this tab, you would put the adhesive onto the baby's body, meaning the tab onto the diaper to keep it on the baby's body, that is not shel kayama. You only want it there for the next, 3 hours, 6 hours, 2 hours until the baby needs a diaper change. Maybe that's not a tov shel kayama, and maybe that's a tzad l'hakel. It's not so pashut if the Rama likes that, but Mekar Hadin, he's probably Mekal. There's another issue, which is more of an issue, and that is when you have a dirty diaper, like a real dirty diaper, usually after you change the diaper, you'd wrap it up, and then you'd close it on itself. You'd attach the adhesive tabs to keep it closed so nothing falls out. And it doesn't, the dirty side doesn't flip outside and make you dirty, make your garbage can dirty. So when you're putting on the adhesive tabs, that might be kayam. You want to leave it there forever. So that kataka be more usr, and that must be avoided. Others could argue that, no, you don't really care about it anymore, you're throwing it out, that's not closed kayama, but that should be avoided. Now, in terms of opening up the tab in the first place, maybe that is opening it up for good. It was always closed, now you're opening it for the first time for good. So some argue that maybe it was made to be open, that's not called tofer, that's not called korea, but so if you want to be machmir, you could open and close the diapers before Shabbos, so that that it's not the first time that they were opened. Okay, now let's move along in the sugya of diapers and talk about ointments. This is a shiloh that rabbis do get quite often, especially during the winter, about people putting ointments on their skin. On Shabbos, I must have gotten this at least 5 times this winter alone, if not a lot more. So we are more machmir with adults than we are with babies, because usually ointments are usually not cholash yesh basakanas. They're never cholash yesh basakanas, ointments. They're usually not even a cholash ein basakanas. So to have a heter for ointments for adults, usually it's a little chapped skin, usually it's dry skin, usually it's, usually it's some kind of skin, something or other. So in most cases, it's hard to find a heter to use ointment on Shabbos. However, for a baby who's uncomfortable has a halacha of a cholash ein basakana, and therefore there's more leniency for a baby. So if we treat the baby like a chola, then we're going to be able to do things kila achayad. So if that's the case, what we do is we take the desitin, or we take the cream, and we just plop it either on the baby's backside. We don't smear it and apply it. We just plop it on in a scoop, Or you could do the same thing, plop some onto the diaper itself. Then you put it on the baby. As the baby wiggles around, the baby will effectively, through its wiggling around, get it to everywhere that it needs to go if you put in a generous amount. And that would be mutter because, again, what it's a chol, baby is a cholashein basakana, and you're doing kilahachayad, there's a tzad lahakel. Others, Ribiyat, suggest that no, if you put it on like that, it's not even mimareach in the first place, and that would be mutter. Sorry? To put it on a diaper and let the diaper move around, or to put it on a... Oh, yes. No, you happen to be right. I was joking. Yes, I have told people that if you want to put bacitracin, again, you have to know if you're allowed to use medicine. But if you're allowed to use medicine on Shabbos, which typically you're not allowed to use medicine on Shabbos, if you put bacitracin on the Band-Aid and then you apply the Band-Aid onto the cut, let's say somebody gets a very deep cut, not something that needs stitches, but a very deep cut that needs to be cleansed. And you have to put an antiseptic on the wound because it's not safe. So how you apply that antiseptic? So you're not going to smooth it onto the wound. You could put some antiseptic, some bacitracin, some Neosporin onto the Band-Aid, and then just put the Band-Aid on the person, and it will shmush by itself. So yes, I think according to that understanding, it won't be mimareach. Okay. You have lots of discussion as far as toys, as far as Lego, as far as puzzles. As far as this happens all the time, and my kids already know, they learned the hard way, that if you take a blanket and you put it over the couch, I'm looking at my couch, you take the blanket and you put it over the couch, the two couches, in between two couches, the arms of two couches, and you make a fort or a tunnel, that is bona. That is bona midrabanan. So all these things we're not going to talk about. We're not going to talk about wind-up swings, wind-up cars. Those could all be potential isurim of makabe patish, potentially surim of avshe milsa if it makes noise. Let's now talk about an eruv situation. Let's say you're in a place where there's no eruv and you want to carry a baby or push a stroller, and the baby refuses to walk. So what are the options? So number one, you bribe with anything and everything. Lots of lollipops, lots of double bubble gum, even though you never let the kids eat sugar gum. Number two, you get a guy. Why? Because, again, you're not supposed to do this, but if you're stuck and you took the kid to shul and now he's refusing to come home, so since we live in a Carmelis, and it's Amila Nachri, so it's a shuas to shuas, b'makom tzar, b'makom choli, b'makom mitzvah. But again, you can't really use this mitchila. You can never ask a guy to take your baby somewhere because you really want to go somewhere. That's not going to fly. Number three, b'shas hadchak, you could do pachos pachos v'dalat amos. You carry, lift up the baby, carry him 3.5 amos, put him down. Lift him up another 3.5 amos and put him down. So that's, again, very b'di'evet, but that would be a last-ditch attempt. Obviously, if you have a baby that you're not confident will go where he goes and back home, then don't take him out in the first place. You can't really ask a guy to push a stroller. We don't have, even though it's a Carmelis, but we're not getting into that. As far as the covers on a carriage is, if it's connected and you're just opening and closing that something that's already connected, that won't be considered ohel. Some say that you have to be open already at Tefach before Shabbos in order to open and close. But if you, that would be okay, you know, okay. But if you take a blanket and cover over the baby carriage or netting or rain cover, that indeed would be a problem of ohel. Okay. As far as sicknesses for a baby, so if you have if there's a fever for a newborn baby, of course that would be a shashi. My son got a fever when he was 5 days old and we had took him to the hospital. I heard from having a final shot.
What are you texting? Okay, so where's the circle? Circle. So we're texting back. 4. We're riding a pony. I ride it on a pony.
I don't know how to do this. Wow. I want to put all those pictures onto the bar mitzvah, but I don't know why it's taking so long to load. Does this always happen? I don't know. I like the picture of the family better.
You press this like a little pen in the corner. Press the little pen in this corner. And if you want to get like one of our pictures, you press upload from device.
Okay.
And then you could try to see through here. Like, no, I don't want that. Watch this picture.
Ooh, that's cute, but I like the other ones better. Okay, why is it not working?